deep in history is independent and in need of your support now more than ever before. Thus, I would like to thank all of my patrons. Every cent I receive goes towards upgrading this experience we share. And hopefully, this year, I will have enough patrons to sustain myself modestly and do nothing but write and record. Thus far, I've refused to run ads for things like sports gambling or any company that I deem exploitive. The ads that pay well, in other words, because I will not advocate for something I would not use myself or recommend to a loved one. This external pressure to structure shows around ads is bringing podcasting as we know it to an end. It is even more difficult for long narrative shows like mine, with eager advertisers asking me to break up my episodes into 27-minute blocks, the average time of a commute to work. That's 21 minutes of content and 6 minutes of ads. But I don't make episodes. I make classic hits you can enjoy forever. The era of a successful indie podcast just existing outside of a corporate network is nearly over. My only hope is to be fully listener-supported. Thus, it gives me such hope and pleasure to welcome Jim, Fiona, Paul, and the Verdant Square Network, who went to patreon.com/deepintohistory and attained the rank of historian for just 15 cents a day. Verdant Square Network, Paul, Fiona, and Jim, my new historians, I salute you and thank you from the center of my being. I would like to extend a special welcome to Big Brother Bruce, who generously chose to support the show at an elevated level. So, Big Brother Bruce, your level of support for Deep Into History is peerless. Consider this a foreword. Because my episodes range from the ancient to the medieval, Deep Into History has been labeled an ancient history podcast by the powers that be in the community. And while I agree I can take you on an ancient trip like no one else can, I am well read on our modern era and find it equally fascinating. I think the reason that I've yet to cover it is that the closer we get to today, the implications of the past, the resonance, is much stronger. This, coupled with the fact that much of it is dark and that most of it is ignored by the media when they attempt to contextualize our time, makes it doubly so. There is a reason for this, of course. It isn't covered because our governments are still operating using the same playbook. And if the general public were well-versed on recent history, we may well start asking why we were repeating the same patterns of behavior and seek to vote in leaders who would stop the chronic cycle of tragedies that is leading to the destruction of our planet and the suffering of billions of people. Continuing the smash hit series Versus is still my top priority, and my enchantment with the ancient will never end. After all, the saga of how the Republic fell to the Empire has many lessons we can apply today. But I have decided to use my voice on this platform you have given me to shed light on more recent history as well. You and I will face the darkness together. And as Deep Into History continues to grow, perhaps, just perhaps, we will reach enough people that we can begin to change things for the better. Because so much that is fed to us in the relentless news cycle we are all trapped in is meant to stoke anger at the gross spectacle that politics has become, pick sides, and keep us divided. No more. You and I are going to do our best to change that. Thank you so much for listening. It is from you that I draw strength to attempt this. I realize venturing into this territory may cause you to feel uncomfortable, because certain established conventional wisdom will be challenged, and mostly utterly refuted with historical facts. It is my hope that we can redefine said wisdom, just as Deep Into History has redefined the History Podcast. Today I bring you the saga of one of the most successful naval actions of all time. But the thing is, you've most likely never heard of it. Or if you have, it exists as less than a footnote, something that some historian mentioned in a paragraph or two. The reason that this raid is so rarely spoken of is that, much like Brennus's raid on the Oracle of Delphi in 279 before the Common Era, it is rather embarrassing to some major world powers. It involved tactical and strategic planning that are the equal of any of the great and terrible historical battles we have experienced together. This naval raid changed the course of the war and shifted the geopolitics of the world, and it is very recent history. So recent, in fact, that my father, Hardeep Hundal, was there, who on December 3rd, 1971, was just coming back to his training ship after celebrating with his friends that they had completed their courses and were set to graduate the next morning to become newly minted midshipmen in the Indian Navy. But then, total war. This episode was supposed to be short and out in December to mark the anniversary of the operation, and as a birthday present to my father. As always, I mean, you know, I needed to give you context, then said context required context of its own. I have gone beyond the normal scope of research and reached out to many professors and journalists to ensure my telling is as accurate and unbiased as possible. A huge thanks to everyone I spoke to. It gives me great pleasure to bring you this epic tale the way it should be told. You know, the way it actually happened. The official accounts are marred by self-aggrandizing generals, admirals, and not least by the fact that operational security required was so tight that no one but a few actually know what transpired. So hey, Dad, this is for you. Consider that as we go forward. And with that said, this forward comes to an end. This is Deep into History, and I'm your host, Arjun Hundle. I would like to begin by introducing two concepts. First, the concept of just war, a theory that has had many iterations from pre-biblical times to the present. The most obvious example of a just war is, of course, the Allies in World War II. However, since that time, so many wars have been presented as just, when in fact they are nothing of the sort. The modern theory of just war holds that seven principles must be adhered to. They are having a just cause, war being a last resort, war being declared by a proper authority, possessing right intention, having a reasonable chance of success, and the end being proportional to the means used. I bring this up because the war we are about to discuss is nearly universally considered to be one of the very few just wars, an extreme rarity in the 20th century. The second concept is that of divide and rule, or divide and conquer, an ancient strategy most famously practiced in the West by Philip of Macedon against the city-states of Greece and Julius Caesar in his conquest of Gaul. It too follows a few basic principles. They are creating or encouraging divisions among the subjects to prevent alliances that could challenge the sovereign, and distributing forces that they overpower the other. Aiding and promoting those who are willing to cooperate with the sovereign. Fostering distrust and enmity between local rulers. Encouraging meaningless expenditures that reduce the capacity for political and military spending. In essence, anything to sow disunity and conflict among the local population, so that they can never unite to challenge their oppressors, which are always vastly outnumbered by the people they oppress. The war in 1971 has its roots, and in many ways are a direct result of centuries of colonialism, as is so much of what is happening right now all around the world. It's been a while since I've delivered you a classic Deep into History historical nutshell, and in this case, I want you to know that I'm merely brushing the surface. Everything I mention in the timeline and everything in between is immensely complex. And as such, I will be posting links for you to do further reading if you wish to expand your knowledge. So, the setup to our setup goes like this. 1600 in the Common Era, the dark cloud of colonial imperialism is rising. Gunpowder weapons, especially rifles and cannons, have given the monarchies of Europe an unprecedented technological advantage. For the first time in history, a raw recruit equipped with a gun can reliably defeat native warriors who have trained and perfected their craft over a lifetime. This, along with advanced ships that form huge blue water navies, and the need for raw materials for very early industries, begin a greedy lust to seize the world. For every kingdom desired to become an empire. England has its eyes fixed firmly on the vast resources and wealth of the subcontinent of India. To get a feel for the geography of the subcontinent, picture in your mind an inverted equilateral triangle, jutting out for its full length into the Indian Ocean in the south, the Arabian Sea in the west, and the Bay of Bengal in the east. Mountains across the top, its northern border, the Himalayas, the colossal natural barrier that rose when the subcontinent slammed into Asia, and has separated the Indian and Chinese people for most of human history, with mountain ranges more or less splitting it in half from the center, thus the modern North India and South India. At the time, circa 1600, the Mughal Empire had control of the central north, the Indo-Gangetic plain, rich and fruitful. The empire included 200 vassal principalities and were surrounded by 700 more who were never friendly, with would-be empires growing on either side of it in Punjab in the west and Bengal in the east. Each principality had its own customs, language or dialect thereof, culture and regional rivalries, resulting in a hugely complex web of interactions. And as yet, the notion of India as one nation had not even entered the minds of the most liberal political thinkers. The divisions were too many. Add vying religions to the mix, and one can see how these divisions were ripe for, well, a tale to be. While other European powers sought a foothold on the subcontinent, the British established the East India Company, or EIC, an early corporation owned by its shareholders, called a joint stock company. Anyone could invest, from the richest to the most modest merchant. Much like a modern startup, investors would get a share of the profits of this speculative venture, depending on the size of their initial investment. This also allowed the royal government to outsource the massive risk of such a huge endeavor. The company's goal is to gain control over all of India eventually, stripping wealth and resource extraction at any cost to generate profit for its investors. With its own army and navy, originally made up of privateer pirates, its executives brilliantly exploit regional rivalries among the multitude of principalities to divide and rule. Its methods are cunning, cruel, and brutal, yet undeniably effective. So much so that by 1757, the EIC has effective dominance over the subcontinent. Those principalities that they could not bring under their influence are crushed, their leaders replaced, to be ruled directly by the company. India's once thriving and advanced textile industries are dismantled and destroyed, only to be resurrected in British towns, and turning the subcontinent into a source of raw materials to fuel them. And the Indian people, a trap market for their goods. Operating not unlike the worst of the late Republic of Rome's tax farmers, the quotas for taxes paid in raw materials such as cotton, silk, wheat, sugar, salt, spices, rice, tea, and opium were very high and had to be met on time every time, regardless of low yields, crop failures, and natural disasters. This caused several major famines, and the people suffered, starved, and died. Brilliantly using the existing Mughal tax system and the ancient Hindu caste system, landholders, called zamindars, were given the quotas and warned if they were not met, they would be replaced, their families destitute, or wiped out if they resisted. Forced, they made their peasants work like slaves, and this directed the poor workers' anger against their lords and not the EIC. The princes who had so readily allied with the company to gain advantage and settle ancient blood feuds with their neighbors soon found that they had made the proverbial deal with the devil. Not only had the garrisons on their land to aid them in settling their petty rivalries become permanent, the EIC enforced a doctrine of lapse, which meant that if a ruler of an allied principality did not have a direct male heir, their lands would be forfeited to the EIC. And this practice vastly expanded the company's direct landholdings. Within a few decades, the company ruled supreme. The company's land, conquered or absorbed, along with its hundreds of vassal principalities, gave them near complete control. Except at the extreme points of the triangle that India is in the map in your mind. The wars to subdue the south, east, and west were brutal. The local Maharajas and their people, who were well aware of the fate that awaited them if they lost, fought doggedly. But without modern weapons, their armies faced inevitable doom. The exception was in the west, for in the land of the five rivers, Punjab, the Sikh Empire stood impregnable. Its rulers had imported modern rifles and even a few cannon from France, along with an army of well-trained swordsmen, spearmen, heavy cavalry, and hundreds of armored Indian war elephants. Two major wars were fought in 1845 and 1848, called the Anglo-Sikh Wars, which I will cover in detail in the future, but understand that both were very near run. At their height, it took nearly all the forces of the EIC on the subcontinent, and had just a few things gone differently, British power would have been fatally wounded, if not broken. And the surviving Sikhs were in disbelief that none of the peoples of the subcontinent took up arms to fight for their own freedom, while company garrisons lay empty during both wars. In truth, they felt betrayed. And thus, in 1857, when the Sepoy Mutiny, an eventual massive rebellion of native troops, broke out in response to the myriad indignities and cruelties inflicted by the company, the Sikhs in general took no part. And this was noted by the EIC and back home in Britain. It was a bloody and brutal rebellion, with far too many nuances to cover. But there are a multitude of books and lectures widely available. But what nearly all of them omit is that in that same year, the first universities were opened in India. These came after decades of effort, campaigning, protests, and petitions from intellectuals. In fact, Karl Marx wrote a series of articles for the New York Daily Tribune, which took note of the plight of the peoples of the subcontinent and the rising unity around the ideas that these intellectuals spread. The beginnings of a movement for Indian self-determination among peoples of all religions, particularly Hindus, Muslims, and Christians, from which could spring a sense of national identity for the first time in the subcontinent's long history. If the people rose together, organized, and worked towards a common goal, the EIC's control and the oceans of wealth that said control brought would be lost. Seeking to exploit any division they could, company agents began a vast campaign of bribing Hindu and Muslim clerics to begin preaching against the peoples of other faiths, empowering the most radical elements and beginning the age of religious strife, divide, and rule. This is not to say that there weren't religious conflicts in the past. There most definitely were. But because of the hundreds of different principalities, these were largely local affairs that rarely spread beyond the borders of a few regions. And as the Sepoy Mutiny came to a bloody close, the East India Company was nationalized by the British throne for its misrule. Yet the EIC's campaign of hatred still spread across the land. And soon, even in peaceful, prosperous towns, populated by Hindus, Muslims, Christians, Jews, Sikhs, and people of all faiths, where they just live their lives, enjoying each other's traditions, the way so many of us do with our friends, the dark sermons of the bribed priests and clerics spread in conversation. We must understand, in many places, these holy men were who the uneducated peasants went to for wisdom, taking them at their word. And because of this betrayal of that trust, for they knew their words carried incredible sway, the people began to see each other differently. The societal sin of otherizing had begun. People finally had others, close at hand, to blame for their poor material conditions. Each sermon sowing division, causing religious clashes, and death, each death magnifying the divisions as familial pain turned to hatred, only to lead to more deaths. As stated, in 1858, the company was dissolved when the Crown bought out its shareholders, in effect nationalizing the company. Beginning the British Raj, when Queen Victoria was proclaimed Empress of India, history unfolded. The peoples of the subcontinent struggled through colonial rule. In 1905, the Imperial Viceroy of India facilitated the partition of Bengal. The religious divisions sowed by the EIC had borne fruit in what would become the model for the future partition of India itself. Hindus and Muslims were forcibly separated, people ripped from their homes and neighborhoods, and the largest state of India, Bengal in the northeast, as large as modern France, was split in two. This proved disastrous and wildly unpopular, and was undone a few years later. The fruit was not yet ripe. Hatred, fear, and terror of one another was not yet felt by enough people. When the war to end all wars, World War I, broke out, Indians served in the British Armed Forces with distinction. Over 1 million Indian soldiers served alongside British nationals. World War I was a turning point for public opinion in the Imperial Corps. White soldiers served alongside Indians and other colonized peoples from across the empire upon which the sun never set. Normal soldiers, normal working people, got to know each other, fought and bled together. Bonds of friendship, understanding, and affection were formed, shattering the concept of racial superiority that had allowed such exploitation. And people in England began to speak up, and the idea of freedom and independence for India spread. After the ravages of World War II, the British Empire, immensely weakened and financially ruined, with immense pressure from the mass movement for freedom led by Mahatma Gandhi, was forced to give independence to the land that had once been seen as the jewel of the imperial crown. However, the religious divisions that had been fostered to maintain control were now hatreds, exploited by fanatics, ambitious politicians, and demagogues. Already, over the decades, rivers of blood had flown in villages, towns, and even cities across the land, which should have been a dire warning of the red tidal wave that would drown the people of the subcontinent soon. These religious hatreds to many prominent and powerful people meant that Hindus and Muslims could no longer coexist as one nation, and the opportunistic spread this message. Thus, in 1947, the partition of India had to happen. Lines were drawn on antiquated maps behind closed doors. There would be a country for Muslims and a country for Hindus and everyone else. The greatest mass migration of people in history. A minimum of 15 million people were uprooted from their ancestral lands, heartsick, looking for someone, anyone to blame for the loss of everything except for what they could carry. The migrants turned on each other. I cannot do justice to all that occurred. The wounds of partition are still fresh for many, and in respect to them, I will just say that it was a bloodbath with at least 1 million people killed. And unnumbered tears shed. War erupted almost immediately between the two new nations. Many objective Indian and Pakistani scholars see partition as a final act of vengeance from a dying empire that decided that if it could not possess its jewel, then no one would. The reason for this is apparent to anyone who looks at a map of it, which I'll post for you on Patreon and social media. For simplicity, the Muslim nation of Pakistan was divided into two separate territories. In the west, consisting of most of the old Sikh empire, Punjab, down south to the coast of the Arabian Sea, bordering Iran, Afghanistan, China on the north, and a long eastern border with India, West Pakistan. Then, across India, the east half of Bengal, surrounded on three sides by India, except the south coast, where its massive rivers flowed out into the Bay of Bengal, East Pakistan. Modern Bangladesh. West and East, one nation separated by over 2,000 kilometers, and between them, their most hated foe. And if not an intentional design to cause chaos, strife, and eternal conflict, it was certainly the recipe for all that happened next. To advance our tale, we'll move through the following years after partition at a swift pace. 1950, the Cold War rages. Out of the ashes of World War II, with Europe utterly ravaged, there are two colossal power blocks. The United States of America and its allies formed the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, representing the capitalist West. The United Socialist Soviet Republic and its allies formed the Warsaw Pact, representing the communist East. The United Nations had been formed to handle disputes between the 51 established nations who originally signed its charter, and to welcome and aid the litany of new nations created in the wake of retreating colonial power. It is easy to look back on this recent history and believe that there are only two sides in the Cold War, two ways for these dozens of new countries to take. But what is so often forgotten is that there was another way. With the world pushed to the brink of nuclear annihilation during the Korean War, the Non-Aligned Nations movement emerged. Among its most prominent leaders, the first Prime Minister of India, Jawaharlal Nehru, Tito of Yugoslavia, Sukarno of Indonesia, and Nasser of Egypt. The movement sought neutrality and friendship through trade with both sides of the Cold War. Its other goals were to aid one another in recovery from the ravages of colonialism. A major problem was that both NATO and the Warsaw Pact would brook no rivals, and there was constant pressure to pick a side in the ideological struggle between capitalism and communism. This other way, this third way, is the origin of the phrase third world countries, referring to political alignment rather than economic status. When you hear it used now, it brings to mind poor and struggling countries, absent the context that they are poor and struggling because of the ravages of colonialism. Picking a side between NATO and the Warsaw Pact brought advantages, above all access to military equipment and advanced technology. The problem was that this always came at a price beyond money, usually allowing for the US or USSR to build military bases in one's country and voting their way in the United Nations, thus trading much internal and international sovereignty for a nominal sense of security. In Asia, China, under Chairman Mao, had secured the Chinese mainland, a revolutionary communist government whose movement grew out of their own struggle against imperialism. Prime Minister Nehru saw China as a natural ally whose people had suffered at the hands of imperial oppressors. But to Mao, India had not fought and won its independence, but was rather given it, which made him suspicious, particularly given that English was the common language that bound the multitude of different cultures together as a nation. They still used the language of their oppressors. Then, in 1959, after the Tibetan uprising, India aided in the escape and gave sanctuary to the Dalai Lama, China's enemy. This brought China closer to Pakistan and confirmed to Mao, at least, that the idea of Indian pacifism was fraudulent. During the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, the world once again on the brink of nuclear annihilation, total war erupted on the subcontinent in the north when China invaded India. The ill-equipped and small Indian army had no chance against the battle-hardened and gigantic People's Liberation Army. The war only stopped because China achieved its stated objective of taking disputed territories and then withdrew from other regions where they had pushed the Indians back as they were internationally recognized parts of India. This defeat was a terrible shock to Prime Minister Nehru, and India abandoned its pacifist international stance and began a military buildup in an attempt to modernize its armed forces. Meanwhile, Pakistan had become a client of America and established strong relations with China. In exchange for U.S. military bases, which India had denied the U.S. government, the Pakistani Army, Air Force, and Navy gained the latest and most lethal conventional weapons in the American arsenal, thus denying them to India. The result was that India equipped itself for war from wherever it could, a mix of mostly antiquated World War II-era equipment, military surplus from countries like France and England. Its only modern weapons came from the Soviet Union. Thus, in 1965, it came as a shock to the West when India and Pakistan went to war over Kashmir, and all that advanced technology proved useless, with the war ending in a UN-enforced ceasefire. How could an army equipped with the latest tanks and aircraft be stopped in its tracks by an army equipped largely with weapons from World War II? I will cover this war in detail in the future, as my grandfather, then Lieutenant Colonel Sudarshan Singh Hundal, became the only commander to take the fortified hill of Kargil twice in two major assaults. Twice because he was asked to abandon the position for political reasons the first time and did so, only to be ordered to take it again, which his battered battalion did, with many casualties. He lost his command and career when he refused an order to abandon the critical position for the second time, the ground of Kargil soaked with the blood of the men under his command. Whenever you hear Kashmir in the context of the conflict today, understand the hill of Kargil lies at the center of it. The 1965 war had major implications for the people of both nations, as they were put under an arms embargo and sanctioned. In Pakistan, officially, the army had been a ruling partner with the civilian government since 1958. The position created for this was Chief Martial Law Administrator. After the war, blaming the civilian government and politicians for the result, the army tightened its grip. Military dictatorship loomed. In India, the effects of the arms embargo by the West meant that it had to rely almost exclusively on the Warsaw Pact for weapons, a further strain on its international stance of non-alignment with the two great power blocs. With the Vietnam War raging, America held out the possibility of lifting the sanctions and embargo in exchange for what its leaders wanted: support for the war in Vietnam, and most of all, a naval base on the subcontinent that would allow control of the Indian Ocean, something India would not allow. And relations, though good under President Johnson, deteriorated rapidly after Richard Nixon was sworn in as president in 1969. He had met India's new prime minister, Indira Gandhi, the daughter of the first prime minister, Nehru, on a world tour before his campaign that so many candidates for president do to establish their international bona fides. Gandhi had maintained a friendly relationship with President Lyndon Johnson, but when she met Nixon, the two had no chemistry at all. Never what anyone would call charming or charismatic, candidate Nixon spoke for nearly 20 minutes straight, until Prime Minister Gandhi switched to Hindi and asked Nixon's escort from the foreign ministry how much longer the meeting would last. Nixon, though not understanding the language, had his famous social paranoia and picked up on Gandhi's boredom at what he was saying. He immensely disliked her from that point on, and as we shall see, his personal hatred was reflected in foreign policy when he became president, especially when he learned that Gandhi had developed very friendly relations with Soviet leaders. In 1969, Pakistan was reeling from internal cultural divisions in the East and West. There was a growing movement from the ethnically Bengali peoples of the East, though largely Muslim, completely different culturally, to attain equality with the peoples of the West. It was then that a general, Aga Muhammad Yahya Khan, from now on referred to as Yahya, forced the ruling government to hand over power to him and declared martial law until national elections were held. The Pakistani split of one country divided by 2,000 kilometers was proving completely unmanageable and completely inequitable. The West was home to all the industry and the cultural elite. The East, what is now modern Bangladesh, was used primarily as a source of natural resources for manufacturing in the West and international trade. In fact, nearly all of the foreign exchange of currency vital for any economy came from the East. Also, the cultural divide cannot be overstated. Remember, each region on the subcontinent is in essence a different country, with different languages, customs, traditions, and even social cues. And as such, West Pakistan was in essence using the East in the same way that any colonial power used its colonies. At the University of Dhaka, the capital city of the East, intellectuals of both the very roughly 80% Muslim and 20% Hindu population joined together as Bengalis, and a reform movement was born and became wildly popular. Then, in the wake of a terrible natural disaster, the Bhola cyclone, which killed over 300,000 in East Pakistan in 1970, followed by a poor, to say the least, response from its government in the West, the Bengali people were fed up. They desired a new equitable approach with a fair share in the resources of their country for everyone. So much so that a month later, in the national election, held in December of 1970, the first true national election, the Bengalis of the East won a major parliamentary majority, and the party called the Awami League, led by Sheikh Mujib, was set to take control of the government, moving the center of power to East Pakistan for the first time. In response, General Yahya Khan suspended parliament and became the de facto military dictator of Pakistan. He met with his generals and a few civilian leaders, and Yahya devised his response to this upstart movement. Under the guise of a post-cyclone relief effort, troops were flown into the city of Dhaka, and any existing commanders who could not be counted on to execute the plan were removed. This culminated in Operation Searchlight. Beginning on March 25, 1971, the city of Dhaka was sealed, the university was besieged, and the massacre began.
The intellectuals and students who formed the backbone of the movement, both Muslim and Hindu, were murdered. Elsewhere, the Pakistani army forcibly disarmed and contained local army units and police, those of Bengali descent. Thus, in the streets, the most radical elements were given free rein to kill Hindus, spreading a lie among the population that all their problems were due to a conspiracy of Hindu scholars in an attempt to divide them. And then it was revealed that among the regular troops that had been moved surreptitiously into the East in the preceding months were Muslim extremist militias from the border regions of the West. These were unleashed on the villages of the countryside. The scale of the mass murder, torture, and rape that followed over the coming months became known as the Bangladeshi genocide. Refugees came flowing over the border into India, which set up major camps around Calcutta, and whose numbers soon swarmed to over 9 million people, both Hindu and Muslim. Anyone who supported the Awami League, the movement for change, fled, for it was a death sentence to remain. Its leader, Sheikh Mujib, was arrested and taken to the West. This flood of refugees caused a crisis in India, as it put a tremendous economic strain on the new nation that was just beginning to be able to sustain itself. As soon as the killings in Dhaka began, the Consul General of the United States of America, Archer Blood, sent telegrams to Washington urging the president to intervene. These were ignored. So the diplomatic staff of the American consulate, 20 established and respected members of the State Department, wrote this telegram. I want to note that Blood himself did not sign it, to prove that everyone at the consulate was bearing witness to the same atrocities, and this was not some partisan play. What would become known as the Blood Telegram read, Our government has failed to denounce the suppression of democracy. Our government has failed to denounce atrocities. Our government has failed to take forceful measures to protect its citizens, while at the same time bending over backwards to placate the West Pakistani-dominated government and to lessen any deservedly negative public international relations impact against them. Our government has evidence of what many will consider moral bankruptcy, but we have chosen not to intervene, even morally, on the grounds that the Awami conflict, in which the unfortunately overworked term genocide is applicable, is purely an internal matter of a sovereign state. Private Americans have expressed disgust. We, as professional civil servants, express our dissent with the current policy and fervently hope that our true and lasting interests here can be defined and our policies redirected in order to salvage our nation's position as the moral leader of the free world. This dire warning of the genocide was not only ignored, and though he did not sign it, Archer Blood would soon be smeared in the press and his career ruined. Slowly, as more and more news of the atrocities came to light in the international media, U.S. allies began questioning why the American government, with near complete and total influence over Yahya of Pakistan, did not intervene. Simple economic pressure would work instantly. The response they got was discrediting of any reports of the dire refugee situation in India and the genocide. The reason for this is President Nixon and his National Security Advisor, Henry Kissinger, were using Pakistan's close relationship with Communist China to arrange the meeting that was meant to be the administration's crowning achievement in international relations, the visit of the president with Chairman Mao in the following year. Though not exactly a state secret, the negotiations being actively conducted at the time were closely guarded by Nixon and Kissinger. The secrecy to conceal the negotiations for the summit from even those at the top of the Nixon administration planted many seeds of distrust and suspicion. When it was subsequently pointed out that France, who hosted the Paris peace talks to end the Vietnam War in 1968, which Nixon's campaign had derailed to deny that victory to his Democratic opponent during the election, could have easily done the back-channeling with China, and still other governments that weren't committing a genocide, Kissinger justified it with a slew of geopolitical nonsense. In truth, it came down to their personal dislike of Indira Gandhi, and the fact that India chose to deny the U.S. a naval base on its territory. Thus, the genocide proceeded unchecked. In East Pakistan, after the university massacre, and with the city of Dhaka under a rule of terror, with civilians killing each other for religious differences, the Pakistani army then moved against the sequestered Bengali police and army units. But some escaped and fought their way into the countryside. These men would form the backbone of the resistance, the Mukti Bahini. They used the refugee camps across the border in India to organize and recruit soldiers, and were soon winning engagements against the murderous militias Yahya had unleashed on the countryside. They began to take villages and even a few towns and gain control of rural regions whose local populations were loyal. But they were desperate for direct military aid from India. Prime Minister Gandhi held a meeting with her general staff, who were split on how to proceed. She wished to avoid a general war at all costs, which she did not believe the Indian Army could win after years of sanctions after 1965, and the now even more glaring technological disparity in arms. In addition, at that moment, India more or less stood alone, with no allies close at hand, while Pakistan was backed by the US, and though unlikely, to the north, China's massive army could choose to aid their ally. It was late April 1971 when she decided to covertly supply the resistance with arms and logistical support, as well as authorizing the Indian Armed Forces to begin covert operations against the Pakistani army in the east in support of the Mukti Bahini. On July 15, 1971, in a televised address to the nation, President Nixon announced the official state visit to China that would take place the following year. This came as a shock to many, as the U.S. had never officially recognized the Communist Chinese government. In India, this confirmed suspicions that the Nixon administration would back its ally Yahya Khan, regardless of the atrocities his army was committing, for his part in brokering the historic meeting that would come to be known as the opening of China. Isolated and alone, India took the only option it had. What followed over the next few months is perhaps the most unsung act of diplomatic brilliance of the 20th century. Every Indian embassy and consulate were activated, with hundreds of additional diplomats dispatched to capitals around the globe, informing world leaders of the genocide and the ever-growing refugee crisis, offering all the chance to send observers to verify India's claims. The Prime Minister split her time between New Delhi, where she managed the emergency, and a flurry of foreign trips to meet with world leaders and to make her case for aid directly, urging them to apply pressure to stop the genocide. This campaign was so successful because the facts were overwhelming, and soon international outrage began to grow. President Nixon's political rival, Senator Ted Kennedy, acting in his capacity as chairman of the Senate Subcommittee on Refugee Affairs, and in a bid to bring some sanity to the administration's position, visited the refugee camps. He was brought to tears after hearing the horrors they had endured and the ongoing suffering of millions who had lost everything to escape the genocide. His words: "The very young and very old were exhausted from many days and nights in flight, usually on foot. Many were in a visible state of shock, sitting aimlessly by the roadside or wandering aimlessly towards an unknown fate. They told stories of atrocities, of slaughter, of looting and burning, of harassment and abuse by West Pakistani soldiers and collaborators. Many children were dying along the way, their parents pleading and begging for help. Monsoon rains were drenching the countryside, adding to the depression and despair on their faces. The tragedy of East Bengal is not only a tragedy for Pakistan, it is not only a tragedy for India, it is a tragedy for the entire world community, and it is the responsibility of that community to act together to ease the crisis. Simple humanity demands that America and the United Nations must accept the truth that this heavy burden should be borne by the entire international community and not by India alone." His visit served to swing international opinion even further against the Pakistani government. However, President Nixon and Kissinger remained unmoved and committed to supporting their personal ally, Yahya. Prime Minister Gandhi scored a huge diplomatic triumph when, on August 19th, her envoys signed the Indo-Soviet Treaty of Friendship and Cooperation in Moscow. Until that moment, India stood alone. The other countries of the non-aligned movement were unwilling to express solidarity because they did not wish to anger the United States and face a certain economic chaos when the famously thin-skinned president would inevitably revoke trade agreements or enact economic sanctions. Across these countries, just barely beginning to shake off the ravages of colonialism, could ill afford. The treaty, while not a formal alliance, was a show of tangible support, and it contained some very interesting clauses. Crucially, it was between India and the Soviet Union, not the Warsaw Pact as a whole, allowing India to keep its non-aligned status in the context of the Cold War. It also made headlines across the world, and any eyes that had not been drawn to the region by the ongoing genocide in East Pakistan and the titanic refugee crisis in India were now paying very close attention to the situation. Even the leaders of NATO countries began asking why the United States of America was supporting a genocidal military dictatorship instead of the world's largest democracy. Suddenly, Indian diplomats in capitals across the world found every door open to them, with the message that Prime Minister Gandhi must take her case to the United Nations if there was to be any hope of avoiding war. A war now that could easily escalate to the point that superpowers would be drawn in and trigger World War III. The Prime Minister had her doubts about the effectiveness of addressing the United Nations directly at this time, because she had reached the conclusion that as long as the United States backed Pakistan, little would be done to alleviate the refugee crisis, and nothing to stop the genocide. Her general staff had begun quietly mobilizing the armed forces for war, and stepped up the insertion of covert operatives, as the guerrilla war raged across East Pakistan and Indian armed forces were moved into position. A meeting with President Nixon in Washington was set for November, a last chance to avert war, or as the Prime Minister calculated, a chance for her to make India's case for the U.S. to step in and aid the millions of refugees who fled the genocide directly to the U.S. media and the American people. The only way in her mind to break the Nixon administration's iron commitment to Yahya. And just to give you an idea of what a terrible ally the general actually was, shortly after the Indo-Soviet Treaty was signed in August, the Soviet ambassador to Pakistan, Alexei Rodinov, was directed by Moscow to send the general a secret message, which has recently been declassified, telling him to come up with a peaceful political settlement for East Pakistan to avoid going through the conflict with India, and then this dire warning, that Pakistan will be embarking on a suicidal course if it escalates tensions in the subcontinent. In the context of this era of the Cold War, a suicidal course of action meant that major powers would be drawn in, making a nuclear exchange likely. It should also be noted that these kinds of messages delivered to leaders of allied or client states on either side were intended to be passed on. This was done to limit direct threats between NATO and the Warsaw Pact, and as a regular form of back-channel communication. General Yahya told no one and continued on his course. This was unlikely to have swayed Nixon or Kissinger, who were singularly dedicated to their meeting with China. From their conversations in the Nixon tapes, their thinking went that if they backed Yahya, they would in essence be showing Chairman Mao what an implacable ally the U.S. could be, willing to overlook anything, including genocide, as if this would be an appealing trait and seen as a boon to the Chinese. If they had the slightest understanding of who they were dealing with, they would have understood that the loss of face that the administration was experiencing, coupled with their complete inability to adapt to a fluid situation, would have the opposite effect, as we shall see. Indira Gandhi's meeting with Richard Nixon began inauspiciously on November 4, 1971, when the Prime Minister was welcomed and then received on the White House lawn before dignitaries and the mass media, both foreign and domestic. In his opening statement, the President did not once mention the situation in East Pakistan, the genocide, or the humanitarian emergency of the refugee crisis. Instead, he gave his sympathies for the scale of the natural disasters that sprang from the terrible monsoon the previous year, ignoring the entire reason for this urgent meeting. The Prime Minister, speaking next, thanked the President for his kind words about the natural disasters, but that India had always recovered from natural disasters, and then said these words, "But the worst tragedy is a man-made tragedy of vast proportions. I come here in search of some wise impulse that has sometimes worked to save humanity from despair." it was noticed that the assembled media were paying very close attention by the sudden clicks of cameras and reporters raising hands to ask questions, showing interest, the crowd becoming captivated by the flawlessly delivered and eloquently worded speech. And seeing this, the White House staffers, without even having to look at him, knew that President Nixon would like this, not at all. He didn't. In fact, at their meeting the next morning, he kept the Prime Minister waiting outside the Oval Office for 45 minutes. While she was waiting, many things that I choose not to repeat were said in the Oval Office about the Prime Minister and Indians. But the words witch and bitch were used. The meeting achieved nothing, apart from the leaders knowing that neither would budge from their position. India would not withdraw its forces mobilizing along their frontier, and America would not exert pressure on General Yahya to end the genocide. Instead, after, the Prime Minister made her case to the American people through the media, and crucially, at many functions held in her honor in Washington. And as she boarded her plane for home, she knew that war with Pakistan was imminent, and prayed that she would be able to conduct it without unleashing World War III. Now you have the context. So, Operation Trident begins after this. I hope you are enjoying the story thus far. I know I enjoy creating them for you, and could really use your help to keep Deep Into History independent and thriving. Please go to patreon.com/deepintohistory and pledge your support. It's just cents a day, and you'll get to experience the first crossover episode of Versus. You see, while Rome had sent its best warriors to wage war in Africa, a threat came from the far north. It started as tales of untold numbers of barbarians appearing at the edge of the known world and devouring all that stood in their way. A lone Gallic warrior, drenched in blood, made his way south to a legionary outpost on the frontier. Yet just as he arrived, he succumbed to his wounds, whispering about witches performing mass human sacrifices and bathing in blood. Rome sent scouts to investigate, and none of them returned. Legions were dispatched, only to disappear as if they had never existed. For Rome had no idea of the sheer number and warrior prowess of the Cimbri and Teutones. Join me for a journey in the dark forest beyond the Alps, and experience a series of strange events that led to Rome's worst defeat since the Republic was brought to its knees by Hannibal at the Battle of Cannae. Bloodthirsty wishes, a sea of barbarians, a stolen treasure that belonged to a denizen of Olympus, a Roman's greed, all leading to the catastrophic Battle of Arausio, in a tale I call The Curse of Apollo's Gold. Available now, only on Patreon. In addition to my ever-growing library of exclusive tales, my patrons receive early releases and will be the first to experience my original five, with the scripts tweaked, style updated, remixed, and remastered in my new Revisited series. Now back to Codename Trident. War erupted on the subcontinent when Pakistan launched Operation Genghis Khan on the evening of December 3, 1971. An all-out aerial assault from West Pakistan to cripple the Indian Air Force and achieve air superiority, immediately followed by a massive armored invasion, thus forcing India to fight a two-front war in the East and West. General Yahya's thinking was that the massive logistical challenge and drain on resources would force India to capitulate and agree not to intervene in East Pakistan again. The problem was that the Indian Army and Air Force were ready. The massive airstrike coming in numerous sorties had little effect. The planes of the Indian Air Force were kept in hardened bunkers and hangars, able to resist direct hits. Apart from the destruction of a radar station and quickly repaired damage to a few runways, Operation Genghis Khan was an epic failure. At midnight, Prime Minister Gandhi addressed the nation on radio. Her words, "I speak to you at a moment of grave peril to our country and our people. Some hours ago, soon after 5:30 p.m. on December 3rd, Pakistan launched a full-scale war against us. The Pakistan Air Force suddenly struck our airfields in Amritsar, Pathankot, Srinagar, Avantipur, Uttarleya, Jodhpur, Ambala, and Agra. Their ground forces are shelling our defensive positions in Suleimanki, Kaimkaran, Punch, and other sectors. Since last March, we have borne the heaviest of burdens and withstood the greatest of pressure and a tremendous effort to urge the world to help in bringing about a peaceful solution, in preventing annihilation of an entire people whose only crime was to vote democratically. But the world ignored the basic causes and concerned itself only with certain repercussions. The situation was bound to deteriorate, and the courageous band of freedom fighters have been staking their all in defense of the values for which we have also struggled, and which are basic to our way of life. Today, the war in Bangladesh has become a war in India, and this imposes upon me, my government, and the people of India an awesome responsibility. We have no other option but to put our country on a war footing. Our brave officers and young men are at their posts, mobilized for the defense of the country. Emergency has been declared for the whole of India. Every necessary step is being taken, and we are prepared for any eventualities. I have no doubt that it is the united will of our people that this wanton and unprovoked aggression of Pakistan should be decisively and finally repelled. In this resolve, the government is assured of the full and unflinching support of all political parties and every Indian citizen. We must be prepared for a long period of hardship and sacrifice. We are a peace-loving people, but we know peace cannot last if we do not guard our freedom, our democracy, and our way of life. So today we fight, not merely for territorial integrity, but for the basic ideals which have given strength to this country, and in this alone we can progress to a better future. Aggression must be met, and the people of India will meet it with fortitude and determination, with discipline, and with the utmost unity. This address galvanized the population, and the nation was united. The 1971 war between India and Pakistan began in the West and exploded in the East. Major battles took place on land and in the sky. But this is a tale of the sea, the saga of the Indian Navy's finest hour. After an embarrassing showing in the 1965 war, had undergone much modernization. It was a polyglot navy made of ships from different nations, from World War II era Royal Navy ships, a recently refitted aircraft carrier, the Vikrant, a few newer frigates, and two cruisers, and its most recent additions from Russia will factor into our tale in a major way, and they were not ships at all. These were boats. Four OSA-class missile cutters. The USSR had designed these for coastal defense, lightly armored but extraordinarily fast, with powerful engines that could propel the boat at an incredible 42 knots. Armed with four Styx, as in the River Styx, anti-ship missiles, the concept behind the OSA was to line the coast with them on launches that would propel them into the sea, where they would speed out in numbers and launch their deadly payloads at enemy ships. An answer to the huge and powerful American carrier battle fleets. These relatively inexpensive boats would swarm an enemy fleet, launch their missiles before speeding away. OSA means wasp in Russian. One major drawback of these boats was that their engines had a lifespan of 500 hours at sea before needing replacement. They literally burned themselves out. In the 1971 war, they were not seen as an offensive threat with no utility beyond coastal defense, and thus a non-factor. For the war, the Indian Navy had been split between the two coasts. East in the Bay of Bengal, a battle fleet centered on the aircraft carrier Vikrant, along with its major surface combatants, to conduct airstrikes and coastal bombardment on the forces carrying out the genocide in East Pakistan. In the West, on the Arabian Sea, the fleet was primarily older frigates and antiquated submarines. Their goal was to pen the Pakistani Navy in ports and enforce a blockade so that no military material, and crucially oil, could reach West Pakistan from its allies. If successful, the blockade would ensure that the war would be short, as Pakistan would run out of supplies with which to conduct it. And since a traditional naval blockade would be impossible, the situation called for something untraditional. For your knowledge, when you hear the prefix INS, it means Indian Naval Ship, or USNS, meaning United States Naval Ship.
The reason that this operation, codenamed Trident, and most other operations during the war have never been accurately reported is that India, surrounded by enemies and wary of spies, had among the most compartmentalized operational security for its armed forces ever known. Quite literally, one unit would have its orders with no idea what others were doing. The grand strategy and overall objective was only known at the highest levels. Thus, it gives me great pleasure to give you the definitive account of Operation Trident for the first time. The way it should be told, you know, the way it actually happened, as told by my father, Hardeep Hundle, who took part in it. Ready? Then let's go. December 3rd, Bombay, India. Out on liberty after celebrating their impending graduation. About to become midshipmen the following morning, four cadets returned to their training ship, the INS Krishna, at 10 p.m. Their ship was undergoing a six-month refit, which had only begun a week ago. The cadets arrived to find a flurry of activity on deck, and instead of being able to sleep off the night's festivities in their berths, they were met by an officer who handed them a list of sailors who had gone ashore. They were each assigned a jeep with orders to retrieve them immediately. When they returned, shortly after midnight, INS Krishna was completely refitted, her boiler steaming. Aware of the continually escalating tension between India and Pakistan, their suspicions were confirmed. The war had begun. December 4th, 2 a.m. The INS Krishna, INS Tir, along with the third frigate, got underway. And where the shipping channel of the port of Bombay met the open Arabian Sea, the flotilla were met by a familiar sight emerging on the water out of the darkness. Three OSA-class anti-ship cutters. Four had arrived in Calcutta shortly after the Treaty of Indo-Soviet Friendship was signed in August. Called by the men of the Indian Navy banana boats because India had paid for them in fruit. They were the latest and most technologically advanced boats in the fleet. These same training frigates and crews, along with another, had towed the brand new OSAs from Calcutta on the far east coast, the only Indian port equipped with cranes large enough to unload them, all the way south around Sri Lanka and north to Bombay but months before. This operation was familiar to them, and that is why they were selected for this mission. Recall the OSA's extremely limited engine life, the reason they had to be towed. Once the cabling operation was complete and the OSA secured, the flotilla began steaming north. Total radio silence had been ordered and was to remain in place for the duration of the operation. Everyone except the highest-ranking officers on each ship only knew that they were headed in the general direction of the city of Karachi, Pakistan's only major deep-water port, hub of international trade, and headquarters of the Pakistani Navy. It was heavily defended by Air Force patrols from two nearby airfields, coastal batteries, and of course, the Pakistani fleet, most of which was still in port at that moment. Traveling at a steady 8 knots, the frigates, unaware to the crew, were escorted by two anti-submarine corvettes stationed beyond the horizon. As Pakistan's advanced submarines were a major threat, these were the diesel-electric French Daphne class. Nearly invisible to sonar when running on their batteries and when they traveled under 5 knots. The flotilla sailed throughout the night and remained undetected. The crews at high alert, sonar stations manned, lookouts posted. December 4th, 1971, the Arabian Sea. Once the task force reached a distance of approximately 100 nautical miles south of Karachi, it maintained this distance for the rest of the day while taking evasive maneuvers, just outside the range of Pakistani air and naval patrols. As soon as the sun set, they began steaming north again, for Indian intelligence reports indicated that most of the planes of the Pakistani Air Force lacked nighttime bombing capability, and any that did would be desperately needed to support the offensive operations on land. At approximately 70 miles south of Karachi, the OSAs were untethered from the frigates. Their powerful engines revved to life, and they rocketed north at 42 knots. Three boats, one objective, Trident, each OSA only carried four Styx missiles. Each missile weighed nearly 5,000 pounds, was 19 feet in length, with a warhead that contained 1,000 pounds of high explosives, each stored in its own tube, two per side, and ran the length of each boat. The entire assault would depend on a total of just 9 Styx missiles being fired. As each OSA had to keep one missile in reserve for self-defense in case they encountered enemy warships during their escape from the raid.
After just 10 minutes of blazing across the water, the OSA's radar systems picked up the presence of enemy ships. 3, one to the northwest and the other two to the northeast. So the Trident split. The OSA, INS Nirgut, altered course to engage the target in the northwest, which radar operators had identified as a destroyer. It was the PNS Khyber on active patrol. At maximum range, 40 kilometers, the OSA launched its first Styx missile at the target. The huge anti-ship missile was erroneously identified as an incoming aircraft. The destroyer's anti-air cannons erupted at the target approaching at Mach 1. The Styx missile struck the Khyber on the starboard side and exploded below the aft galley in the electrician's mess at 22:45 Pacific Standard Time. The ship immediately lost propulsion, electricity, and was plunged into darkness. Then the number one boiler room exploded, engulfing the ship in thick black smoke. PNS Khyber sent out an emergency transmission to the Pakistani Naval Headquarters. It said, "Enemy aircraft attacked in position 020FF20. Number one boiler hit. Ship stopped." In the chaos and panic after the explosion, the transmission not only sent the incorrect coordinates of the ship's position, which resulted in delays in rescuing survivors later, but had all Pakistani units in the area looking for a non-existent airstrike. With its target still afloat, the OSA fired a second Styx missile, which was seen approaching and again engaged with anti-aircraft guns from the decks of the Khyber. The missile struck the number two boiler room on the starboard side, sinking the PNS Khyber immediately. To the northeast, at 2300 hours, the second prong of the Trident, the OSA INS Nipat engaged its two targets that were sailing north to the port of Karachi. Verifying the targets on radar, the OSA launched one Styx missile at each. The first at the merchant vessel Venus Challenger, and the second at its destroyer escort, PNS Shah Jahan. Indian intelligence believed that MV Venus Challenger was carrying ammunition for Pakistan that had been redirected from US forces fighting in Vietnam. The ammunition on the Venus Challenger exploded as the missile struck. The blast and inferno lit up the horizon. The second Styx missile hit PNS Shah Jahan, which was crippled, the black smoke plume outlined by the flash of the explosion miles away. Then, 20 minutes later, the minesweeper, PNS Muhafiz, was targeted by a Styx missile from INS Veer, the third prong of the Trident. The missile hit the minesweeper on the port side just after the bridge, instantaneously disintegrating the vessel before it could send an emergency transmission to Pakistani Naval Headquarters. The OSA, INS Nipat, continued towards Karachi. Its radar picked up dozens of ships in port, both merchant vessels and the bulk of the Pakistani surface fleet. But they were not the target. Instead, the crew locked onto the Kamari oil storage tanks of the port refinery and prepared to launch from 30 kilometers south of the harbor. Two missiles were fired at the tanks. One of the Styx misfired, causing a system failure aboard the OSA, but the other stayed on course and hit a fuel tank, which exploded and consumed other tanks nearby, the inferno briefly turning night to day. Their mission complete, the OSAs turned south, rocketing back towards their motherships of the flotilla. An additional detail never before reported. At the flotilla, on the bridge of the INS Krishna, the crew was eagerly awaiting the return of its OSA. Yet when it came within sight, the returning missile boat remained circling outside of gun range. And soon, the training frigate was painted by the OSA's missile radar. You see, the OSA was wary to approach because the outline of the frigate was exactly the same as many of the frigates in the Pakistani Navy, because so many of both fleets were attained from the British and were of exactly the same class. Thus, friend or foe was impossible to tell on sight. It has been erroneously reported that the flotilla was under orders to speak Russian over the radio in an emergency situation. This is not true. In a series of desperate Morse code signals, using the Krishna's lights, identifying the ship as the Osa's allies, the signals flashed out, repeated again and again. Minutes filled with tension passed, until finally the crew of the Osa understood that they had safely returned to the flotilla. The cabling operation began immediately, and once all three prongs of the Trident were tethered, the flotilla turned south to make the journey back to Bombay. In Karachi, the fire at the port burned late into the next day. Operation Trident had been a resounding success. However, since one of the two missiles that had been targeted at the oil facility had failed, the damage done was not total. Pakistan's oil reserves had not been entirely crippled as planned. And critically, the tanks containing jet fuel, the life's blood of the Air Force, remained mostly intact. And as the raid had been reported as an aerial attack, the Pakistani Air Force had stepped up its patrols, making an airstrike by the Indian Air Force to finish off the oil facility impossible. With nearly all of its major surface combatants in the Bay of Bengal, the Indian Navy had no hope of maintaining a traditional blockade on Karachi. Thus, it kept a few frigates south of Karachi, just outside of the range of the Pakistani Air Force, as the flotilla had done before, presenting a tempting target for the Pakistani Navy. This was by design. One immediate effect of Operation Trident was that the owners of the merchant shipping fleets of the world were pulling their ships in Karachi out and sending any that were on course there elsewhere. So with the tempting targets of the Indian frigates just out to sea and the flood of merchant ships leaving port, the Pakistani Navy began sending its surface fleet out interspersed with foreign cargo vessels to assemble and break the fragile blockade, leaving Karachi open to another attack. So it was that on the night of December 8, 1971, 4 days after, a second, smaller version of Operation Trident was launched. Recall that India had bought 4 OSAs from Russia, and only 3 had been used thus far. Once again, using the cover of night, the follow-up operation occurred. Codename Python. A single OSA, INS Vinash, was towed close to Karachi, rocketed north, and at maximum range, launched all 4 of its Styx missiles. Before turning to return to its mothership, the missiles were targeted and had locked onto every remaining oil asset in port. The first Styx hit the remaining tanks at the oil facility, causing an inferno so bright that it was seen from hundreds of miles away, and the other 3 respectively scored direct hits on the Panamanian fuel tanker SS Gulfstar, the fleet tanker PNS Dhaka, and the British merchant vessel Harmattan carrying crucial war material. The result of the major Trident and minor Python raids was to cripple the Pakistani war effort, not only terminally disrupting the economy by forcing all trade away from West Pakistan, but the inferno of the blazing oil facility spread, destroying all warehouses that stored recently delivered ammunition from its allies. The blaze kept spreading, and the port of Karachi was rendered useless as it burned for 7 days, what turned out to be the duration of the war. Cutting off Pakistan from all war material and most trade from the international community by the effective loss of its largest port, and isolating the country from its allies. These 2 naval raids had the world baffled. No one had any idea exactly what had occurred, other than it was unlikely to have been a strike from the Indian Air Force. In Washington, at the White House, in the Oval Office, there was panic and definite rage, because without immediate military intervention, Pakistan and General Yahya would lose the war. In fact, in the east, the Pakistani forces were in danger of being surrounded in the city of Dhaka. And in the west, the Pakistani army was taking horrendous losses, unable to dislodge the Indian army from its prepared defensive positions, despite their technological superiority in tanks and artillery. So in answer, President Nixon ordered the 7th Fleet, centered on the largest aircraft carrier in the world, the USS Enterprise, nuclear-powered, and with nuclear bombs for its aircraft in its holds, to sail into the Bay of Bengal from its station in the Gulf of Tonkin. A massive escalation of the crisis from a country that until that moment had declared it was not involved, though the move was officially reported to the media as a relief force to allow, if needed, the evacuation of the Pakistani army in the east. The fact is that the 7th Fleet was about to enter a war zone, and the only way to achieve this objective would be to sink the Indian Navy, and since it, designated Task Force 74, had no transport ships, it was seen as an act of aggression by the rest of the world. As war had officially been declared by India, a foreign battle fleet entering the Bay of Bengal to support an ally entering Indian waters would be taken as hostile, meaning that to India, given all that had happened in the previous year, it appeared that the United States Navy was getting ready to sink the Indian and then launch an air war on the Indian Army advancing in the east, a general war against the Indian Navy on the water and in the skies against the Indian Air Force, a war India could not hope to win. Mobilizing Task Force 74 of the 7th Fleet would take days, as its ships needed to be resupplied. Days that India desperately needed to end the land war in the east. That is, in the nascent country that the world press was beginning to call Bangladesh, to the chagrin of the Nixon administration. Since the conversations about the war from the Oval Office are long, I have pulled a few quotes from them and created a summary of the discussions. The president wondered if he was, quote, too goddamn easy on that woman when she was here. Nixon felt he needed to show the Chinese, Russians, and Indians that there was, in his words, a man in the White House, referring to Task Force 74 steaming towards the Bay of Bengal, and inquired of Kissinger when the Chinese were going to mass the People's Liberation Army on the northern border with India, forcing them to end the war to counter the move, and then if, quote, that bitch didn't stop the invasion of East Pakistan, the Chinese would invade. Quote, but let me tell you, she's going to pay. She's going to pay. You may be asking yourself why the president thought China was willing and able to escalate the crisis out of all proportion and start a war that would cost tens, if not hundreds of thousands of lives. You see, the thing is, Henry Kissinger had been playing up his relationship with the Chinese for months in order to make his role in setting up the historic summit between China and America vital, for posterity, of course, and also to become indispensable to his boss. The truth is that China wanted this meeting as much as the US did, wishing no longer to be isolated from the West and no longer perceived as a junior partner in the communist world. In fact, since the Sino-Soviet split after the death of Stalin, it was China's goal to make itself geopolitically one of the three great powers, NATO, the Warsaw Pact, and China, a tripolar world in the terms a political scientist would use. In Chairman Mao's mind, China had asserted its dominance over Asia, and this meeting would be the first major step in that direction, as the US had not even officially recognized the government of China as an official entity, instead recognizing the government of Taiwan as the legitimate rulers of the Chinese mainland. And because of this, there were several back channels well underway, not least through France and Romania. China had been reaching out to the West, an obvious signal of China's desire to be officially recognized, and in exchange, offering to broker a peace in Vietnam, backed by the word of Chairman Mao and the full power of the People's Liberation Army. This rather glaring nuance was completely ignored by the genius Kissinger, an obvious omission by one who knowingly served the administration that had destroyed the peace talks that had very nearly ended the Vietnam War in 1968. On December 9, 1971, with the port of Karachi ablaze, in the Oval Office, the director of the Central Intelligence Agency warned the president that, quote, East Pakistan is crumbling, and that the Indian Army had annihilated the bands of fanatic militia General Yahya had unleashed in the countryside, and was approaching the capital city of Dhaka from three directions. This was where the bulk of the Pakistani army was stationed, and if surrounded, the war would be lost. On the 10th, committed to Yahya, President Nixon ordered, quote, keep those carriers moving now. Note the plural carriers. We'll come back to that in a minute. In the afternoon, Henry Kissinger reached out to the Chinese liaison he was in contact with at the UN for the coming historic meeting and asked if China would, quote, intimidate the Indians, and was immediately met with the response, as best as I am able to convey it, of, wait, what? No. You see, beyond being the emissary of his president, in Chinese eyes, he had no pull and had just lost face because of the magnitude of what he was asking, completely ignoring the fact that the US now needed China if there was to be any hope of making peace in Vietnam. In that context, China held a rather large chip in Kissinger's own game of realpolitik, and to use it would take convincing talks and accommodations. You know, diplomacy. To ask for a possible invasion of India failed to recognize China's position and relative strength. Speaking about their conversation later, that same Chinese emissary would say that, quote, Kissinger talked about the fact that the US would be moving ships into the area, about military supplies being sent to Pakistan from Jordan, Turkey, and Iran, exposing the existence of illegal arms shipments. Having utterly failed, Kissinger was forced to tell the president that as far as the Chinese were concerned, independence for East Pakistan was a foregone conclusion. Angry, blaming the Chinese, not Kissinger, the president resolved to put his faith in brute force, in the form of Task Force 74, to intimidate India into an immediate ceasefire and withdrawal from East Pakistan. Also on the 10th, Indian intelligence intercepted a US naval message saying that the 7th Fleet was approaching the Bay of Bengal. Then, to make matters worse, came shocking news when Moscow warned New Delhi that in the east, entering the Arabian Sea, was a British fleet. This exact detail I cannot confirm. There are conflicting reports about its accuracy in terms of British intentions. The Royal Navy's Far East fleet was in the area, but the United Kingdom had maintained a strict policy of neutrality in the war thus far. But what I can confirm is that the warning was received, and to the Soviets and Indians, it appeared that the US, with the help of the Royal Navy, was attempting a naval pincer movement that would at once allow direct military support in the east and allow the third-party illegal arms shipments and critically oil to start flowing into West Pakistan again. In response to this alarming news, Prime Minister Gandhi summoned the Soviet ambassador and officially invoked Article 9 of the Treaty of Friendship and Cooperation. Article 9 reads, "Each high contracting party undertakes to abstain from providing any assistance to any third party that engages in armed conflict with the other party. In the event of either party being subject to an attack or threat thereof, the high contracting parties shall immediately enter into mutual consultations in order to remove such threat and to take appropriate effective measures to ensure peace and security of their countries." This somehow completely overlooked diplomatic legalese was in effect a pact of mutual defense. Thus, Moscow directed all of its naval assets in the Indian Ocean to the Bay of Bengal, and in the Far East, in Siberia, at the port city of Vladivostok, the Soviet Pacific Fleet began urgent preparations to set sail to the Indian Ocean. During the next few days, as the Indian Army closed in on Dhaka, there was a tsunami of diplomatic activity across the globe seeking to de-escalate the crisis. A series of resolutions were offered by many countries at the United Nations. Anything to stop the war on the subcontinent from spiraling out of control. Alarm was rising at the thoughts of the two superpowers confronting one another in a war zone. Their two fleets, with more firepower than was unleashed in all of World War II, justifiably put the world on edge. Early in the morning of December 15, 1971, USNS Task Force 74 crossed that international line and entered the Bay of Bengal. On board India's only aircraft carrier, INS Vikrant, pilots were volunteering to commit suicide for their country by flying their Harriers loaded with bombs into the Enterprise. The Indian Navy had no chance against even this single task force of the 7th Fleet. But then, just as the planes were being fueled, Moscow sent a message to Washington, warning that not only was an American fleet about to enter Indian territorial waters, but there were Soviet ships in place escorted by nuclear submarines. with the Soviet Pacific Fleet but days away, as well as sharing the news that the Indian Army had now entered Dhaka and that the war would be over in mere hours. Something of an exaggeration, as the Indian Army had only moved 2,000 troops into the outskirts of the city, as crossing the mighty rivers of Bangladesh was proving a tremendous challenge. Finally, without hope of turning the tides of war, according to some sources, a Soviet submarine surfaced in order to be pinged on radar to confirm Moscow's message. The president ordered Task Force 74 back to the Gulf of Tonkin, just barely averting an incident that would have likely caused World War III. As it turned out, the only reason the isolated Pakistani forces holding Dhaka had not surrendered already was that they were justifiably terrified of reprisals from the population for the genocide they had unleashed. Thus, Indian generals Arora, a Sikh, and Yaqub, a Jew, just to display the diversity of India in practice, guaranteed the safety of all surrendering soldiers and their repatriation back to West Pakistan. So on December 16th, the 26,000 Pakistani troops in Dhaka surrendered, joining the POWs already captured from the countryside, for a total of approximately 90,000. At once, Prime Minister Gandhi issued the following statement, and it was cabled to capitals around the world. "I have repeatedly declared that India has no territorial ambitions. Now that the Pakistani armed forces have surrendered in Bangladesh, and Bangladesh is free, it is pointless in our view to continue the present conflict. Therefore, it is our aim to stop further bloodshed and unnecessary loss of life. We have ordered our armed forces to cease fire everywhere on the Western Front, in effect from 8 p.m. tomorrow, December 17th. It is our earnest hope that there will be a corresponding and immediate response from the government of Pakistan." That evening, the Prime Minister addressed the Indian Parliament, and this address was simultaneously read to the UN General Assembly by the Minister of External Affairs at the United Nations in New York. "I have an announcement to make which I think this House has been awaiting for some time. The West Pakistani forces have unconditionally surrendered. Dhaka is now the free capital of a free country. The instrument of surrender was signed at Dhaka at 4:31 p.m. by Lieutenant General Niazi on behalf of Pakistan Eastern Command and Lieutenant General Jagjit Singh Arora, Commander-in-Chief of Indian and Bangladesh forces in the Eastern Theater, accepted the surrender. This House and this entire nation rejoice in this historic event. We hail the people of Bangladesh in their hour of triumph. We hail the brave young men and boys of the Mukti Bahini for their valor and dedication. We are proud of our Army, Navy, Air Force, and Border Security Force, who have so magnificently demonstrated their quality and capacity. Their discipline and devotion to duty are well known. India will remember with gratitude the sacrifices of those who have laid down their lives, and our thoughts are with their families. Our armed forces are under strict orders to treat Pakistani prisoners of war in accordance with the Geneva Convention, and to deal with all sections of the population of Bangladesh in a humane manner. The commanders of the Mukti Bahini have issued similar orders to their forces. Although the government of Bangladesh has not yet been given the opportunity to sign the Geneva Convention, they have also declared that they will fully abide by it. It will be the responsibility of the government of Bangladesh, Mukti Bahini, and Indian armed forces to prevent any reprisals. Our objectives were limited: to assist the gallant people of Bangladesh and their Mukti Bahini to liberate their country from a reign of terror and to resist aggression on our own land. The Indian armed forces will not remain in Bangladesh any longer than is necessary. The millions who were driven out of their homes across our border have already begun trekking back. The rehabilitation of this war-torn land calls for dedicated teamwork by its government and people. We hope and trust that the father of this new nation, Sheikh Mujibur Rahman, will take his rightful place among his own people and lead Bangladesh to peace, progress, and prosperity. The time has come when they can together look forward to a meaningful future in their golden Bengal. They have our good wishes. The triumph is not theirs alone. All nations who value the human spirit will recognize it as a significant milestone in man's quest for liberty." And the address concluded, "Bangladesh fought and bled for its freedom and its people's right to self-determination. The cost had been astronomical in lives and suffering. At least 1 million civilians had been killed in the genocide, though the number may be much higher. 10 million refugees had been displaced, their lives ruined. And the lead-up to the war had seen one of the worst breeds of organized mass rape the world has ever known. The 1971 Indo-Pakistani War is widely considered one of the last just wars. It ended a genocide and freed an oppressed people. And in recognition, history has recorded it as the War of Bangladeshi Independence. Aftermath. Though the war had proven to be an utter defeat for Pakistan and its allies, it proved to be Prime Minister Gandhi's finest moment. Her use of diplomacy in such a massive and prolonged effort to avert a war was held up across the world as an example, the pen and the sword in a just cause. For the briefest instant, a shining beacon to the world that there was another way, and the world reveled in it. And then, like a lit match in the wind, it was gone. General Yahya resigned in disgrace. During the war in December, a widely published column written by journalist Jack Anderson titled U.S. Tilts to Pakistan, which contained confidential information from classified documents regarding unofficial U.S. diplomatic policies towards the crisis. To find and stop the leak, Nixon assembled his team that would become to be known as the Plumbers. They discovered that the leak had come from a yeoman stenographer, Jack Radford. He was spying on the National Security Council on behalf of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who had become concerned of being cut out of decisions during the secrecy surrounding the lead-up to the announcement of the China visit, and continued spying because they had become concerned over the influence Henry Kissinger had over the president. This was covered up for fear that when made public, it would destroy morale in the military. But it would come to light a few years later when Nixon's Plumbers would cause the scandal history has come to know as Watergate. Legacy. The reason Nixon's opening of China does not resonate throughout the world as it does in the US and the UK is that to achieve it, his administration chose to embrace a dictator executing a genocide when there were other, better options. And as many objective historians and political scientists have come to agree, that while historic was required, because Chairman Mao's help was required to force the North Vietnamese back to the negotiating table, which they were loath to do, as it was the Nixon campaign that scuttled them in 1968. A sentiment reflected in a Gallup poll in 1972, after the opening of China, where Indira Gandhi was proclaimed the most admired leader in the world. As for the Prime Minister, she became to be very nearly worshipped in India, and unfortunately would embrace megalomania. Suspending democracy in 1975, and end up sowing and exploiting religious divisions, causing riots and massacres, and would eventually lead to her assassination by Sikh extremists. President Nixon would end up resigning in disgrace after the Watergate scandal, one that never should have happened had the public been trusted with the truth that his campaign scuttled the peace talks in 1968, which was known by his rivals at the time, prolonging the war, costing thousands of American soldiers their lives, hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese, and millions in the illegal bombing of Laos and Cambodia. This war crime was never addressed. Henry Kissinger would go on to serve as Secretary of State, enjoy a sterling reputation for diplomatic brilliance, and sit on the board of directors of many major corporations, and remains widely respected, particularly among the elite and powerful, to this day. This lack of accountability would allow future administrations to commit acts like prolonging the Iranian hostage crisis to win an election, Iran-Contra, and the list goes on and on. Universities are attacked in our current discourse for the same reason they always have been. It is on these campuses where we meet, mingle, share ideas, learn, and shed the prejudices we are all raised with to some degree or another, where the concepts, policies, and norms that are used to divide us are challenged and unity is formed. Divide and rule. The East India Company and the age of colonialism have left us the legacy of racism, which was used and spread to justify the slave trade and the murder and exploitation of indigenous peoples of the colonies. Our very concept of race stems from this, and is used to divide us to this day. The EICs, playing off of principalities against one another, can be seen in the way corporations move factories from town to town, state to state, country to country, for the slightest advantage in profit, as well as the on-paper movement of headquarters to avoid paying taxes. All of this comes at the expense of the people, their communities, and our planet. The movement of non-aligned nations continues and now includes 120 countries. In this post-Cold War era, it opposes foreign occupation, interference in internal affairs, and aggressive unilateral measures, but has turned its main focus on the socioeconomic challenges facing member states, especially the inequalities manifested by globalization and the implications of neoliberal policies. The incursion of Task Force 74 into the Bay of Bengal is rarely mentioned, but it is a major hinge point in history. It convinced Prime Minister Gandhi that it was imperative India have its own nuclear bombs as a deterrent. It resulted in Operation Smiling Buddha, the first detonation of an Indian atomic weapon in 1974. Aggression leads to nuclear proliferation, sadly, a lesson that we have failed to learn. As for the OSA-class missile cutter, after the war, when it was finally discovered how the raid was pulled off, demand for the boat skyrocketed, serving in the fleets of navies across the globe. And because of Operations Trident and Python, the way in which anti-ship missiles were deployed would forevermore be changed. Afterward, I cannot recommend highly enough reading the book The Blood Telegram by Gary J. Bass, winner of far more literary awards than I could possibly name, of the largely forgotten story of the Bangladeshi genocide and the political actors we discussed. I also want you to know I realize that I have shattered some illusions today. In university, one of my favorite books was Diplomacy by Henry Kissinger. After taking political science, I thought he was an intellectual icon. But after listening to you and reading the transcripts of the Nixon tapes in recent years, I have come to see the lies and omissions in that book as condemning. He was wrong about far more than he was right, and is a war criminal. But don't take my word for it. Listen for yourself and read the transcripts at nixontapes.org. If you have questions, comments, or wish to discuss anything about this, I am always available to my patrons. Up next in Deep into History, in honor of Black History Month, we will move through the streets of Chicago in 1969. Because everyone always tells the story of how Fred died, we'll experience how Fred Hampton lived in a tale I call Fred Said. Then, refreshed, I can't wait to come back to our genre-redefining saga of how the Republic fell to the Empire. First, a detailed and delicious examination of the Roman legions and how Jupiter's Chosen would leave his mark on the Republic's chief instrument of virtus forevermore, followed by a mystical encounter with the spirit of Rome's greatest general that would transform Roman understanding of the universe. Versus continues with the Marian reforms like you have never experienced them before in Reforma, then the interlude Scipio's Dream, both serving as the end of the prelude to the titanic Cimbrian War. Thank you for listening to Deep into History. I hope you enjoyed Codename Trident. You can follow me at Deep into History on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. Please tell everyone you know about this show. It's now or never for me. And as always, my dear friend, take care of yourself. I truly look forward to the next time we go deep.